Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, tells the visiting Pope Francis that Christian citizens should live in peace, as well as other Iraqis. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab threatens to stop performing his duties to pressure politicians to form a new government. And Britain registers 158 new coronavirus deaths and more than 6,000 new cases. Welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Iraq this hour, where top Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, in a meeting with Pope Francis, has emphasized the role of religious leaders in resolving crises facing humanity. Ayatollah Sistani said many regional countries, including Palestine, are suffering from injustice, war, and blockades. He said the religious leaders have to encourage the involved parties of conflicts, particularly world powers, to prioritize rationality over confrontation. He said leaders have to urge these parties to avoid expansionism and personal interest. Ayatollah Sistani also said Iraq's Christian citizens should live like all other Iraqis in peace and security. He underlined the importance of concerted efforts to prepare the ground for coexistence between all people based on mutual respect. Ayatollah Sistani met with the visiting Pope at his home in the Iraqi city of Najaf. Activist and West Asia expert Said Shahabi has commented about the significance of the Pope's visit to Iraq and his meeting with Ayatollah Sistani.
The opportunity to have the Pope going to Iraq, visiting the Marja, the big jurist in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani, at the place where the leader of the Shia Muslims, Imam Ali, is buried. So this is significant. Now, we also have to look at the background of this visit, and we must not forget the efforts by many people before that. Iran started to have dialogue with the Pope from the very first days of the revolution, when they opened their embassy in the Vatican. And then, of course, there were many delegations from Iran to the Vatican to establish this dialogue between Muslims, Shia Islam, and also the Catholic Christianity. Iraqi scholars have been going also in the last few years to Vatican several times. They met with the Pope. But also, we must not forget that he had visited Cairo also. So he considered, he wanted to establish dialogue with Muslims through Azhar, Al-Azhar in Cairo, through Najaf in Iraq. And of course, this was prepared by the efforts of those early visitors to the Vatican.
The Iranian president has urged Iraqi officials to speed up the enforcement of a parliamentary ratification mandating the expulsion of U.S. forces from the Arab country. In a phone call with the Iraqi Prime Minister, President Rouhani said the move will help establish peace and security across the region, including in Iraq. He reminded the fact that the U.S. has always played a destructive role in the region. The Iranian president also expressed opposition to foreign meddling in Iraqi affairs, which he regards as detrimental not only to Iraq but to the entire region. He stressed Iraq's integrity and security remain a priority for Iran. In response, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadhimi thanked Iran for helping to establish peace and stability in Iraq. He also underlined the need to expand all-out bilateral relations. Lebanon's caretaker prime minister has threatened to stop performing his duties to pressure politicians to form a new government. Hassan Diab says if isolation helps with cabinet formation, he will be ready to resort to it. He says this is against his will because it disrupts the entire country and is detrimental to the people. Diab's cabinet resigned following last year's August explosion in the capital, Beirut, that claimed the lives of more than 200 people. Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was nominated in October, but has failed to form a new cabinet due to the political deadlock between himself and President Michel Aoun. Israel is facing an ICC probe into war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The investigation includes Palestinian deaths in the 2014 war on Gaza and the March of Return rallies, as well as Israel's illegal settlements. While Tel Aviv's closest ally, Washington, has expressed opposition to the probe, saying the Hague-based court does not have jurisdiction over the matter.
The United States remains on a collision course with the International Criminal Court, even after the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump yielded power to the Joe Biden administration, which was expected to be softer on issues related to international organizations. The reasons for the troubled relations have remained unchanged: the ICC's decision to probe war crimes committed by the United States and Israel. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who has been probing war crimes committed by Israel, the U.S., and their allies, said in December 2019 that such crimes have been or were committed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She named the Israeli military, which has for years unleashed a reign of terror on Palestinians, as the perpetrator of war crimes. The ICC prosecutor further noted that there was a reasonable basis to launch a probe into Israeli military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip, as well as illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. Bensouda then asked judges to rule on the extent of the court's jurisdiction in the case, and the court last month established that it had jurisdiction. The announcement was not received well by Washington and Tel Aviv. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. opposes any such probe, as the court has no jurisdiction over the matter. The phone call followed U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's statement that Washington firmly opposes and is deeply disappointed by the decision.
If the state is very certain and very secure that the Israeli regime and these occupiers have not committed war crimes, so why not give a chance to the investigators, the bipartisan group that will be coming in, that is not biased, and they will be investigating all the cases that they have in their files, in their system, and to prove that they're innocent, right? And then at that point, we don't have this continuous problem coming up and arising again.
The U.S. and Israel have repeatedly shown their opposition to being held accountable for their actions over the years.
The ICC is opening up a formal investigation into war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territory. Is a welcome move, but will it actually translate into action on the ground? For example, the ICC also opened up an investigation into American troops' war crimes in Afghanistan. However, the U.S. blocked the inquiry, putting the investigation on hold. Well, the ICC jurisdiction plays an important role here. It does need the cooperation of authorities to be able to investigate the crimes. Yet, in the case of Israel, how can this even make a difference? After all, Israel commits crimes that violates international law in the occupied Palestinian territories practically every day.
The ICC, which has often sought to expose war crimes committed by the Israeli regime and the U.S. around the world, has faced bullying and intimidation from both Tel Aviv and Washington. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on the Hague-based tribunal staff last year, targeting them with asset freezes and travel bans, accusing them of violating the U.S. national sovereignty by launching a probe into war crimes committed by the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The Biden administration took no immediate action to reverse the move, despite promising to put overruling Trump's damaging measures on top of his agenda. The new U.S. administration did announce it would rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council, which its predecessor withdrew from 2018, citing an anti-Israeli bias, but it said upon re-engaging with the UN body, it will press to eliminate a disproportionate focus on its Israeli ally.
I mean, this shows essentially from the beginning that they're not going there really for human rights. They're going there to secure and support Israel and to bury their war crimes and to get people away from holding the Israeli regime accountable. I mean, why is there all these resolutions in the first place against Israel? Obviously because there's continuous developments, there's continuous war crimes, there's continuous bombardments, there's continuous blockades, there's continuous crimes.
We will be back. And I'm a man of my word. America's back. I speak today as President of the United States at the very start of my administration, and I'm sending a clear message to the world. America is back.
Joe Biden has repeated this sentence multiple times since becoming president, taking a veiled sideswipe at his predecessor's isolation foreign policy and promising a return to multilateralism in a bid to win over the estranged U.S. allies and revive the frosty transatlantic relations. While Washington's European partners have largely expressed support for his administration, divisions between them still persist. In the latest example, an EU spokesperson said, "The bloc supports the ICC as an independent and impartial judicial institution with no political objectives to pursue." Peter Stano was responding to a request for comment on Netanyahu's recent diatribe against the court, who had blasted the war crime probe as, quote, the essence of anti-Semitism. President Biden says he will bring back what he calls America's moral leadership in the world. The question is, how can the U.S. advocate such leadership while it continues to penalize those who work to expose crimes instead of the true culprits?
Taliban militants say the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan has met with their representatives in Qatar to revive a bilateral deal. A spokesman to the militant group says Khalilzad and the top U.S. general in Afghanistan met with the Taliban negotiating team late on Friday. Both sides expressed their commitment to last year's agreement in Doha and discuss its full implementation. Earlier this week, Khalilzad had held talks with Afghan leaders in Kabul. This as the Taliban militant group has called on the U.S. and its allies to withdraw their forces from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The Taliban made the call on the first anniversary of a peace accord sealed with the United States in Qatar. Under the agreement, Washington is to pull out all U.S.-led international forces from Afghanistan in May. Well, Iran has reported over 8,000 new coronavirus cases and 82 more related deaths. The Iranian Health Ministry says 527 people have been hospitalized over the past day. Over 1.4 million people have recovered from the contagion. The number of new cases and deaths in Iran has sharply dropped since November, when the country imposed tough restrictions to curb the pandemic. However, officials have sounded the alarm over the public's failure to fully observe health protocols, as well as the spread of the more contagious British variant of the virus. Iran has also been developing its own vaccines and importing jabs. Overall, the country has registered nearly 1.7 million infection cases and over 60,000 deaths. Though many countries across Europe have reported more COVID-19 infections and deaths, the United Kingdom has registered over 6,000 new cases during the past day. Government data shows a slight rise in new infections since Friday. The country has confirmed more than 4.2 million cases. Britain has also reported 158 new deaths. This is while 21,800,000 Britons have received the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy's health ministry has reported over 300 daily deaths and over 23,000 new infections. The country's total cases now stand at over 3 million and fatalities at 99,000. A shipment of more than a quarter million AstraZeneca vaccines destined for Australia has been blocked from leaving the European Union. Now, big pharma companies are being pressured to honor their contracts as frustration grows across the bloc. The vaccine rollout is going very slowly and supply is dwindling.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia, but nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies and additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Continuing with more news this hour. Egypt's president is calling for a legally binding deal regarding Ethiopia's gigantic hydropower dam on the Nile River. In a visit to Sudan, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi reaffirmed the necessity for returning to what he calls serious and effective negotiations on Ethiopia's dam. Earlier this week, Khartoum and Cairo called for global mediation over the matter. Addis Ababa has rejected the proposition. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been a bone of contention for years, and numerous rounds of talks have borne little fruit. Ethiopia insists that the hydropower dam is necessary for its economic development. Egypt and Sudan, both lying downstream on the Nile, complain that the project endangers their agriculture and access to water. And now to Thailand, where hundreds of protesters have gathered in the capital, Bangkok, despite a ban on public gatherings. Protesters gathered in front of the criminal court building. Police have increased security, and water cannons could be seen waiting behind the gates. Protesters risk being arrested, while police say they are prepared to use harsher measures to control what they call unruly demonstrations. Last week, rallies became violent when police used rubber bullets, tear gas, and water cannons to disperse the crowd, leaving 10 protesters injured. Ralliers want a rewrite of the army-drafted constitution and reforms to the monarchy. They also want the premier to step down. Rallies have been held since July of last year. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
Leap in manufacturing and production is one of the major strategies within the framework of a resistant economy, as it speeds up establishment of stable infrastructures. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said that the current trend of production and manufacturing in the country is insufficient and stressed the need for strengthening manufacture and production. The leader pointed to prohibition of imports as one of the prerequisites for leap in production. He said, "We're not opposed to imports, but we emphasize that the product that is made or can be made within the country shouldn't be imported." Dear listeners, agriculture is one of the key sectors in Iran's economy. The production of strategic crops is important in the sense that it contributes to the country's independence and provides the path for reaching an ideal economy. Stay with us for more. Presently, there are three staple crops which play a basic role in the basket of Iranian families, namely wheat, rice, and oilseeds. Turning into a developed country with the first rank in the region in scientific, economic, and technological terms, and food security, especially the maximal production of strategic products, are among the main objectives of Iran's development plan, which have been addressed in the leader's statement for the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. No doubt, reaching the specific goals in the plan require development of human resources and proper application of scientific and technological principles in all sectors of the economy, with a leap in production, particularly in the agricultural sector. Oilseeds are considered as a source of energy as well as cereals. The oil has nutritious value for human beings, and the oil cake is used for food for livestock due to high amount of protein. These seeds are also used in industry. According to Ali Reza Mohajer, an expert in the Ministry of Agriculture, an important index for evaluation of food security in macro level is the rate of self-sufficiency of food products, or the scale of provision of basic nutritious needs from the domestic production. This will not only enhance the country's global reputation, will also indicate the improvement of agricultural productivity, efficiency of capital and workforce in agriculture, effectiveness of government policies, and rural development. These factors will lead to economic growth, saving of hard currencies and foreign exchange, reduction of dependence, and reinforcement of national security. Because of Iran's diverse climate and a highly trained and efficient workforce, a survey of successful countries has indicated that cultivation of oilseeds shows that Iran can minimize its dependence on these products. Not long ago, production of oilseeds was limited to just soybean, sunflower, and cottonseed, mainly in northern Iranian provinces. Currently, however, canola seed has been prioritized due to climatic conditions, autumn cultivation, and little need for water. Presently, near 220,000 hectares of land have been dedicated to the cultivation of canola seed. Thus, it is estimated that over 400,000 tons of canola will be harvested from the farms. In view of this, more than 30% of foreign exchange has been allocated to the production and extraction of oil seeds annually, so that over $41 billion has been the value of oil seeds imported for the past 25 years. To put it more simply, the dependence rate has been nearly 90%, which leads to high vulnerability, especially at times of sanctions. It has been planned to cultivate approximately 70,000 hectares of land with soybean to yield some 160,000 tons of the seed, 20,000 hectares with sunflower to yield nearly 30,000 tons of the seed, and 35,000 hectares have been dedicated to cultivating sesame seed to yield around 40,000 tons of the product. Increase in production of oil seeds will not only promote job creation and secure parts of national need for nutritious oil, it will also provide oil cake for consumption in animal husbandry. Thus, it can indirectly contribute to securing protein and solve the per capita energy consumption in the country. Self-sufficiency in production of oil seeds is considered very important, and the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted this issue in previous years. He has said, "We should reach self-sufficiency in the field of oil seeds, especially canola seed." As it was mentioned, canola can be cultivated in autumn and can benefit from autumn rainfall. It can be cultivated in various provinces of Iran and can be cultivated alternatively with other cereals. The high quality of canola has turned it into one of the best oils to produce. Furthermore, its cultivation has positive effect in sustainability of production, controlling cereal diseases, better functioning of the next product, and improvement of agricultural soils in general. In order to enhance health conditions and decrease consumption of harmful oils, the cultivation of oil seeds such as canola has been seriously put on the agenda of Iran's agricultural ministry.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the blessings of the congregational prayers and the imam who leads the congregational prayers when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah? So, dear listeners, we talk about the congregational prayers and how
they directly affect our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah. An interesting thing that we have been talking about is how this congregational prayers, which is led by an imam, a prayer leader, has a direct effect not just the prayer itself, but how the prayer leader, the imam, the leader of the congregational prayers also has a direct impact upon our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah. We had talked about in previous episodes how the prayer leader needs certain requirements, they need certain spiritual aspects which they must have in order for them to be the leader of the prayers in a congregation. For example, we talked about how they need to be just, they need to have knowledge, they need to implement their knowledge, they need to be righteous and noble and honorable and pious and God-fearing, and they need to implement Islamic laws upon themselves. Of course, these are all requirements for an imam, a leader who is leading the congregational prayers. And of course, we had said that when this imam, this leader, has these qualities, then the Muslim brothers and sisters, you and I, the people of the community, they also are inspired to be like that individual who is leading the prayers, to be noble and righteous and honorable and just. Now, it's interesting, we find in this book of traditions by the name of Mustadrak al-Wasail, in volume number 1, page 490, a tradition which says that the leader of the congregation must be one whose faith and commitment the people trust. So a very beautiful requirement, or a very beautiful characteristic of this prayer leader in the congregational prayers, is that that individual's faith and their commitment must be trusted by the people. So the people trust that this individual is strong in their faith. They are committed to the faith. They are committed to Islam. They are loyal to Islam. Their faith is steadfast. They have determination and willpower upon this path. Now, of course, when the people see these aspects of an individual to the extent where they start to trust these things about this individual, then of course it is rational and it is logical that the people will also want to be like this. They will want to have steadfastness in their faith, determination in their faith. They want to be committed to the religion, committed to the deen. And this is what is done indirectly and perhaps directly via this prayer leader, this imam, in the congregational prayers, that directly or indirectly affects our ubudiyya of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to this segment of the program, Foresight. My name is Muhammad, and today I'd like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatul Muti'in Lillah. Please stay with me. Us in the ships of your deliverance. Give us to enjoy the pleasure of whispered prayer to you. Make us drink at the pools of your love. Let us taste the sweetness of your affection and nearness. Allow us to struggle in you. Preoccupy us with obeying you, and purify your intentions and devoting works to you, for we exist through you and belong to you. and we have no one to mediate with you but you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. Now, in continuation to this subject which we were talking about, of course, which was the congregational prayers, their effect, and how they enhance our ubudiyah, and of course, the congregational prayers themselves in their own aspect, they enhance and strengthen our ubudiyah. But of course, there is a great and important role which can be seen in the leader of the congregational prayers and how it helps us and inspires us to be like that individual. Now, along these lines, we find in this book of traditions by the name of Al-Wafi, in volume number 2, page 177, where the esteemed, loyal, faithful companion of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon them both, a companion by the name of Abu Dharr al-Ghaffari. Of course, many of us know this individual as being a very famous companion of both the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali. So Abu Dharr al-Ghaffari, he says, "Your Imam is your intercessor, your Shafi, on the day of resurrection, the day of Qiyamah. So do not let your intercessor, your Shafi, be among the ignorant and transgressing people." A very beautiful tradition brought to us by Abu Dharr al-Ghaffari, and it makes sense because the prayer leader, the Imam, in this aspect is the one who is our intermediary. We consider him to be better than us as far as piety and righteousness and honorableness and nobility. We consider him to be better as far as implementing the Islamic laws and being a person who is close to Allah. And so because we consider him better than we are, we put them forth in front of us and pray behind this individual, for he is the best among us. And so they do become a Shafi, an intercessor, an intermediary by default, not just for our prayers, but also on the day of resurrection. And so, of course, we must be very, very careful, dear friends, that this intercessor, this intermediary, this Shafi, not just in our congregational prayers, but our Friday prayers, and even on the day of resurrection, may it not be an individual who is an oppressor, who is ignorant, who is an aggressor, and who is a transgressor. May Allah protect us from this. And so just as the Imam can have a positive influence upon the community, there is also a very real threat that they can have a negative influence on the community. And so, at the end of this segment, let us always remember that it is our duty to make sure that the one who is leading these prayers, the one who is leading the community, must be one who falls under the requirements, characteristics, and qualities set forth by the Ahlul Bayt, by the Holy Prophet, by the Quran, by Allah.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah,
ya Allah, ya Manan, haqqaq
amani. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rahman, haqqaq amani.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Amali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A lot of youth are turning to religion, but some of them become very extreme. They start interpreting verses and narrations and coming up with their own theories that are not based on any solid evidence, but rather on the weak understanding of religion. And the moment you disagree with them, they start attacking you. This is a problem, but it is never too late to change. What you need to do before you start memorizing information is to work on your spirituality, to clean yourself through losing your ego. Reading is very important, but it's not enough. It is like you have a cup of water in front of you. You read how tasty the water is, how pure it is. Reading can give you some information about the water, but it doesn't make you taste the water. When you work on your spirituality, when you work on cleaning yourself and destroying your ego, you will get a chance to taste how pure the water is. And when this water goes down into your heart, it will remove extremism and it will fill your heart with love to everyone. It will make you accept everyone, even those who you disagree with. It will make you open up to everyone, to love good for everyone, because religion is nothing other than love. Lose your ego to win yourself. Understand that you are nothing to receive everything. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Foresight on IRIB English Radio. It's great to have you with us. Thanks for staying with us until this last segment. We've been talking about the important and integral role of the imam, the one who leads the congregational prayers, when it deals with our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. So we had talked about how this individual must be one who, according to the traditions, their faith and their commitment to Islam and their commitment to the faith must be trusted by the people. This in turn will create a feeling, it will influence the people to also create this feeling of faith and determination in Islam and their commitment to Islam. Of course, we also talked about in the second segment a tradition from Abu Dhar al-Ghaffari, who says to be careful who your imam is and who is placed as being your imam, who is also selected to be the imam, the leader of the prayers, because this individual is an intermediary and is also an intercessor, a shafi, on the day of resurrection, and you don't want a bad guy to be your intercessor. Matter of fact, you want to be as far away as you can from oppressors and tyrants and dictators and evil people on that day of resurrection. We bring one final tradition regarding the imams and how it relates to our ubudiyah, the imam of the congregational prayers, where again we find in this book of traditions by the name of Wasa'il al-Shia, volume number 5, page 416, there is a very beautiful tradition from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, who says, "The imam of the congregation is one who leads you towards Allah. So be aware of whom you are following." A very beautiful, a very profound tradition here, which tells us so many different things. First and foremost, that the imam and the prayer leader in the congregational prayers is definitely a means of increasing and enhancing our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. And how? Well, apart from the many different things which we have listed in previous programs and in this program, of course, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam says that this individual leads you towards Allah. And so, of course, this person who leads you towards Allah, he takes your hand and guides you towards Allah, definitely enhances our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. And of course, as Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, peace be upon him, said at the end of his tradition, be aware, be careful, this is a warning to all of us. Be aware and be careful and be wary of whom you are following. Don't follow just anybody, because the Imam is the one who leads you to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Ilahana ma'ada lak malika kun liman malak labbayka qad labbaytu lak.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expensive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions, and Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation in the coronavirus pandemic. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions by other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julie Bossman and Lucy Tompkins. The piece is titled, Texas Drops Its Virus Restrictions as a Wave of Reopenings Takes Hold. Texas said on Tuesday, 2nd of March, that it was lifting its mask requirement and would allow businesses to fully reopen, the most expansive step by any U.S. state to remove coronavirus restrictions as Americans across the country are eager to emerge after a year of isolation. The move by Texas, with its 29 million residents, goes further than similar actions in other states and cities that are rushing to ease as many limits as they can. It is now time to open Texas 100%, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, adding that COVID has not suddenly disappeared, but state mandates are no longer needed. All around the country, governors and mayors are celebrating what is feasible, what is safe, and what is politically practical. In Chicago, Illinois, tens of thousands of children returned to public school this week, while snow-covered parks and playgrounds around the city that have been shuttered since last March were opened up again. Mississippi ended its mask mandate too. Restaurants in Massachusetts were allowed to operate without capacity limits, and South Carolina erased its limit on large gatherings. San Francisco, California announced that indoor dining, museums, movie theaters, and gymnasiums could reopen on a limited basis. But federal health officials have worried that state and local leaders may be moving too fast. I know people are tired. They want to get back to life, to normal, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, said on Monday. But we're not there yet. The divergent guidance has left many Americans in a quandary, wondering whether to follow the lure of optimism as some officials in California, Michigan, and North Carolina endorse widespread reopenings of businesses and schools, or to heed their own lingering concerns about the coronavirus and the warnings of federal health officials who have said it is premature to lift too many limits. As Kitty Sherry, a 36-year-old, sent her son Jude off to his Chicago elementary school this week for the first time in nearly a year, she felt caught in a middle ground between elation and worry. "There's a part of me that's really excited that he's back in school," Kitty Sherry said, but she said she worried about the health risk to teachers and said her family was still avoiding restaurants and other indoor spaces because of the coronavirus pandemic. "It's not over yet," she said, "so there's not too much celebration." Government officials have sent mixed signals, often cautious messages, to the public. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor for COVID-19, said this week that for small groups of people who have all been fully vaccinated, there was low risk in gathering together at home. Activities beyond that, he said, would depend on data, modeling, and good clinical common sense, adding that the Center for Disease Control, CDC, would soon have guidance for what vaccinated people could do safely. The message that many Americans are hearing from their elected officials, including leaders from both political parties, is upbeat. Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan said on Tuesday that she was easing restrictions on businesses and allowing family members who have tested negative for the coronavirus to visit nursing home residents. Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts said that while residents should continue to wear face masks in public, it was time for more limits on businesses to be eased. In Kentucky, all but a handful of school districts are now offering in-person classes, while the state races to vaccinate teachers as quickly as possible. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear told reporters last week that the state's falling infection statistics showed that immunizations were beginning to make an impact. "It means vaccinations work," he said. "We're already seeing it. We're seeing it in these numbers. It's really a positive sign." In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott's lifting of limits goes into effect on 10th of March. some Democrats sharply criticized the idea, saying it suggests a more optimistic picture of the state's progress with a coronavirus than the reality. There are reasons for optimism. Vaccinations have increased significantly in recent weeks, and daily reports of new coronavirus cases have fallen across the country from their January peaks. The positive signs come with caveats, though. Though national statistics have improved drastically since January, they have plateaued in the last week or so, and the United States is still reporting more than 65,000 new cases a day on average, comparable to the peak of last summer's surge, according to a New York Times database. The country is averaging more than 2,000 deaths per day, though deaths are a lagging indicator because it can take weeks after being infected with the coronavirus to die from it. Also, new, more contagious variants of the coronavirus are circulating in the United States, with the potential to push case counts upwards again. Testing has fallen 30% in recent weeks, leaving experts worried about how quickly new outbreaks will be known. And millions of Americans are still waiting to be vaccinated, including workers in restaurants, which are now open in vast numbers across the country. In states like Florida or South Dakota, schools and businesses have been widely open for months, and many local and state officials across the country have been easing limitations since last summer. Still, the pace of reopenings has quickened considerably in the last few days. We're hopefully in between what I hope will be the last big wave and the beginning of the period where I hope COVID-19 will become very uncommon, said Robert Horsberg, an epidemiologist at Boston University's School of Public Health. Horsberg added, "But we don't know that. I've been advocating for us to just hang tight for 4 to 6 more weeks." Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said there are signs that the country may be through the worst of the pandemic, but she's still worried that states are reopening too hastily, repeating the same mistakes made in earlier periods of the coronavirus pandemic when loosened rules were followed by new spikes in cases. Rather than opening a new lower risk things and seeing just to make sure it doesn't change the numbers, it just feels like they're just kind of opening the floodgates, Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo emphasized.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.